Hi, everyone. My name's Sandy Miller. I'm from Avanade. I'm based in Canberra. I'm a group manager there, and I run our small infrastructure team there. Been around in the exchange land for a little while now. So today we want to talk to you about, is virtualizing exchange a good thing to do or the right thing to do? Did anyone go to the session last night on putting exchange on Hyper-V? You know, a few people? Well, I've got some less than flash news for you because some of the slides that I've got today are the same as last night. But what I'm going to do is just, I'm going to have quite a different spin on those. I'm coming from a design perspective, you know, the things you need to think about when you're making that decision or when you're designing an exchange solution to run on a virtualized platform. So my discussion is not about Hyper-V or VMware or anything like that. It's just about virtualized hardware. So I'm just trying to come at it from an exchange point of view and the things you need to think about. So just a little bit about me. I've been with Avanade for a couple of years. Before that, I was with Microsoft for 12 years. Done a lot of work with a product team. A friend of mine down here, Scott, who you probably went to his HA session yesterday, is going to help me answer questions at the end. So Scott gets pretty involved in a lot of these sorts of things and has a great depth of knowledge around these things. So the sorts of things I do in my job, I predominantly work on Exchange. I do a lot of design work with Exchange, hence wanting to speak to you today about what I see going on in this space and how I make decisions or I help customers make decisions or sometimes decisions that are made for us. You know, they are the things we face when we design an Exchange solution. I've worked on some pretty big ones. I'm currently working on a 50,000-seat deployment, which is a consolidation from three other messaging platforms, from two from another vendor and a legacy Exchange 2003. Yeah, we are going on to a virtual platform for that one. It has got some challenges around the design, and I'll cover some of those as we walk through. So again, I apologize if you've seen some of these slides before. The way I was going to approach this is really from a best practices point of view, because if you're not baking best practices into your design, you're probably going to end up in a place that you don't want to be. In terms of, you know, the performance, you know, you've really got to think about the performance of Exchange, and most people forget that there's somebody sitting in a laptop or a PC or a tablet or a phone or whatever at the other end of what we create, and they're using it, and their experience is really what we should be, you know, front of mind about what they get. And this is where often, you know, people forget that, and they make all sorts of decisions about how Exchange should look and be and all the constraints that you have to pile on top of yourself when you do these things and forget about those users. I try to take the opposite view. I think about I am that person. And in fact, I am that person in my company. I am a user of email. I have the same sort of considerations and thoughts that your users have or you have in using email. So it's important to consider those. So I always come at it from that perspective. We need to provide a good service to users. So the best practices are a great place to start with that. And it might sound a bit trite when you say, oh, best practices, blah, 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 and, you know, but at the end of the day, you know, some people, some smart people have sat down and worked these things out through labs, through scale labs, through usability labs, and all of that sort of stuff. So they don't come about by accident. And also, too, there's the whole supportability aspect of what you do as well. You don't want to put in a platform which is not going to be supported by either Microsoft or by your virtualization vendor. It's important that you marry those two views together and get something so when you pick the phone up, someone's going to say, yeah, I can help you with that, or you don't want the answer, which is often the case. Put that on a supported platform and then let's see if it happens there and then we will help you. You know, your mail's down, the data's broken, you know, it's too late after that. You've got to be thinking ahead of that. So best practice is a good place to start. So, you know, does it make sense? How many people currently virtualize Exchange today? Well, quite a few. So how many of those are on 2003? Couple? Oh, you're in non-supported land, but anyway. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, it does work. Yeah, there's no question about that. But, you know, again, you know, you make decisions for different reasons. You've probably made decisions for business reasons or some other driver around what you're doing, and that's a decision you make. But again, all decisions have consequences. So let's look at, you know, there is no conclusive answer. I have no answer for you today because I live in the land of consulting. And who can tell me what the standard consulting answer is? Anyone? It depends. Yeah, it absolutely depends. And there's a lot of things it depends on. And some things you might not even think it depends on, but it does. And it's really a matter of looking at all of those, or as many as you can get your arms around, because often you come into a large organisation and you don't have all the answers. You don't know what they are. A lot of systems that you may be upgrading or replacing are many years old. They've been managed by hundreds of people. Documentation doesn't exist. The decisions that were made aren't documented. You have to look at those things. So it just depends. So just when you go into that, understand why you're doing it. People virtualise for a lot of different reasons. We'll cover some of those off shortly. But understand why you're doing it and making sure you're getting out of it what you want. And again, from my point of view, as I explained before, it's the user experience you should be thinking about. It's what they get. But again, the business is paying for that, and often that has a lot of sway in what the users get. It's not a unlimited supply of goodness. One of the problems with virtualising Exchange is the whole scale out, scale up thing. Exchange, by design, is scale out. You need more stuff, more compute, more storage, more capability, you scale out, you put more boxes in. It does that by design. Whereas virtualization, on the other hand, is quite the opposite. It's by a bunch of big fat machines and stuff as much stuff on it as you can. They are sort of diametrically opposed to some extent. So be aware of that. And the big trap there is the all eggs in one basket scenario. And I've seen that a number of times recently where people haven't really thought about the placement. And this is not just exclusive to Exchange, by the way. This is other things as well. Two cluster nodes in the same blade enclosure. How clever is that? You lose the blade enclosure, your clustering's not going to do much for you. You're done. Go home. So, think about those things. And that's often the trap. So just be aware of that scale out, scale up approach that you need to think about when you apply your thinking to this. Couple of reminders, and again, I know this was gone through yesterday. Exchange doesn't know it's virtualized. It's just seeing hardware. Whether it's physical or virtual, it's hardware. It doesn't know. And on the other side of that, the virtualization platform doesn't know what Exchange is. So just be aware of that. They work independently from each other. Virtualized hardware is hardware. You've got to take into account the overhead. It's 10 to 12-ish%, depends on your hypervisor vendor. You've got to account for that. Nothing's for free here. It's one of the myths, if you like, of virtualization. People think you get all this stuff for free. Well, you don't. And Exchange is what I call a big app. It's big CPU, it's big memory, it's big I.O. Sometimes that doesn't fit well in a virtual infrastructure. Certainly I've had some situations recently where, because of constraints in the platform, we're going to be putting some boxes on that are going to be running at probably up to 80% CPU based on our calculations. There's going to be 16 of them. That's a big weight, a big load to put on a virtual infrastructure. Would the virtual guys be happy with that, especially with some of the constraints around moving them? Don't know. Have to answer that. And from an Exchange point of view, account for the overhead. Again, a couple of unsupported things. And from a design perspective, you have to think about this stuff. You can't not think about it. And the biggest one here is snapshots. From a design point of view, if you don't say you don't want them, well, then you have them by default, because usually that's the default configuration here. They're just not a good thing. Exchange is a going-forward application. You can't go back in time with Exchange. It's not like a batch system where the system falls over and you get people to key the data back in. Exchange is not like that. Mail is a dynamic, ever-changing, go-forward-in-time thing. You cannot go back in time. So snapshots are completely out. So when you're designing that, the implications there are in your operations. And when you apply it to a virtual platform where snapshotting is pretty common, you've got to turn those sort of facilities off, build that into your operation infrastructure to make sure that you're backing Exchange up in a meaningful way. So snapshots out. Differencing a Delta disk, same thing. So you just can't go there with that sort of thing. Excuse me. Oversubscription. I always love it when people say, I've got 25-to-1 ratio on my virtual hardware. And that might be great for those applications that get used once a month, or they're a low-level database or a web service or something like that. That's fine. But like I said, Exchange is not one of those. Don't get confused. It is a big application. So just consider the oversubscription. Because if you oversubscribe, over-allocate what their basic, over-subscription, I should say, what you're saying is, I know you need it, but I'm not going to give it to you. So from a design point of view, that's not particularly clever. So think about what you're doing. And again, go back to your, also go back to your hypervisor vendor. They also have different guidance around specifically Exchange, knowing that it's a big application. So check out what they're saying as well. I think VMware in their last guidance, it was don't oversubscribe at all. That's one-to-one cause. Applications running on the root, that's obvious. That's just a straight performance thing. Running SQL Server on a root machine that's running Exchange is just, you know, you're just not giving it what it needs. So, you know, that's pretty obvious. And VSS backups of root devices, again, that's pretty obvious. There's lots of information around about that sort of thing. It's just Exchange has got to know the data's been backed up because it has some maintenance tasks to do during that process. Sizing and capacity. So this is one of the things I do all the time. And I love the role calculator that Microsoft has. Has anyone ever used that, the Exchange one? Anyone, a few people? Oh, that's really, that's great because it is, you know, up until now it was a bit of a, I don't know, dark art. there was a lot of guesswork involved and it was hard to collect your thoughts around all of the things that mattered. Well, with the role calculator that simplifies it, you can see it. But again, assumptions are king here. Make sure your assumptions are good because we all know the old computer adage. So watch out for that, technical guidance, all that sort of thing. Account for the overhead, covered that. Placement, I covered this earlier in the all eggs in one basket scenario where, with the placement of certain roles, if you like, if you lose an enclosure or a virtual host or whatever, a host machine, you know, you could be losing more than Exchange can cope with based on your HA design in Exchange. So, again, be aware of that. And then obviously all the sizing bits, and I'll cover that off a bit more shortly. Rules of thumb, again, I'm not going to drill down on this, it's just really an informational slide. The things that you should do and shouldn't do, it's pretty obvious. There's some really good guidance around about this. Again, follow what your vendor says, use the role guide calculator, and come up with something that works for you, because it's always a compromise to some extent in fitting in with the various platform constraints. Popped in their networks as well, because people often discount, the importance of networks in this environment. Networking in a virtual environment is quite complicated, especially when you've got HA and HA networks and replication networks and this network and that network and the client network. You know, the actual load on it can build up quite quickly. An example would be an average Outlook Anywhere client on 2010 does about 5 kilobits per second across a business day. That's sort of an average, so it's not a peak or anything, just an average. You've got 5,000 clients on there, you're at 25 megabits, you've got 4 CAS servers on there, you're at 100, you've got the traffic, the mappy traffic out the back end, you're at 200. It doesn't take long for these numbers to get really big, plus when you've got all the HA pieces as well, so it's important to consider those things from a design perspective. And make sure that all of the network loads are right, because again, networking, especially in blade enclosures, can get very complicated very quickly, and it's good to have some good networking folks on your side to help you with that. UM is one of the new supported roles with SP1 along with live migration. There's a few points here, I'm not going to cover those off, except to say, anything to do with voice or unified communication, it's a real-time thing. If you don't give it the performance it needs, guess what? Not a very good user experience, and again, that's one of those things I think about quite a bit. So just watch out for that one, and now that that becomes available, does anyone use Exchange UM? A few people? Yeah. Does anyone virtualize it? Yep. Oh, nearly put your hand up. Yeah, I haven't seen one yet, and I'm looking forward to doing that, and really getting an idea of what that looks like in the real world, because I think it's an interesting thing, and often one not considered with Exchange for whatever reason. Root server sizing, I'm not going to cover that off. There's one thing there about heartbeats you've got to watch out for. Certain activities with virtualized machines can take a little while, so from an Exchange point of view, you need to consider the heartbeat configuration. CPU sizing is actually quite an interesting one, because your root hardware really is one of the driving forces behind some of the design decisions you're going to make when you're putting Exchange on virtual hardware. And that's because of the way the hypervisors at this point in time, don't scale across sockets very well. So if you've got a 4-socket host or root machine, you're kind of limited to four cores if it's a four-core machine for your guest. And that can present a bit of a problem. You know, typically when I design an exchange solution, I try to go for, you know, I come from a commodity hardware point of view. I don't want to go out and buy expensive, you know, massive big machines. I want to, you know, it's all about, you know, keeping the cost down. So I typically either target 4x2s or 4x4 type machines because they're relatively cheap, you know, lightweight, you know, 2U type machines. Where if that's your virtual host, you're kind of limited by the 4, the 6, the 8 cores on the socket. That can present a bit of a problem. So an example I had recently was I ended up, based on the population, it was that 50,000 seat one I mentioned before, where I ended up with 16 cores for the mailbox servers. Well, in their virtual environment, I can't have 16 cores. I can have, in this case, 6. So you look at that from a very simplistic point of view, and you sort of say to yourself, well, heck, I need 2.5 times as many servers to provide the compute power for the mailbox role. That's a lot of extra exchange servers across 50,000 people. You've got to really think about that. That's an extra cost for licensing, for operations, for, you know, and then the other operational costs like backup agents and AV agents and all that other stuff that builds to the cost of a machine. That's a big cost. So that's the simplistic view. The sort of more interesting view, if you like, is one that fortunately I take a pretty conservative view on average CPU. When I design a mailbox server, I typically target around 40% because the numbers you have going into a design are usually at best a guess or an idea, or if you're coming off another vendor's mail platform, you typically have no idea. You know, they are at best an assumption. So I tend to be very conservative, and I actually target around 40%, where you can happily run an exchange server at, you know, 70-75%, you know, is reasonably good guidance. I'm just a bit more cautious than that. So in this particular situation where we're going, I wanted 16, I can only have 6. So what does that do to the CPU? Well, it takes me from around, I think it was about 38, to 65. Is that still okay? I think it's okay. It's not where I'd like to be because my headroom is now gone. And so, you know, so I'm going to end up in a place, potentially, if the load's more than I assumed, that I'm probably going to have to put more servers in anyway. But that's part of the design trade-off that we all go through when we do these things. So, you know, it's just something to consider. Don't take a simplistic view when you're looking at the number of cores you need, and just be open-minded about how you might achieve the outcome. But also, too, bear in mind, the performance of the mailbox server is the biggest determinant into the user experience. Slow database equals slow user performance. So just remember that as well when you're looking at that. And you know, again, follow, Microsoft has some great guidance around, you know, the sort of CPU levels you should be targeting yourself for. So, you know, it's important to understand that. And when you're laying that on top of a host or a root machine, you know, having four large mailbox servers on one piece, you know, one physical server, you know, you've got to decide whether that's a clever idea or not. Mostly not. So, you know, just watch out for that when you do that, and the placement becomes quite important over time. Won't cover that one off. Deployment. This is a really interesting one, because one of the features of virtualization is that you can move workloads around. You know, that's a benefit which I think most people look for, you know, either the dynamic balancing of workloads, green IT, where you can move workloads and shut physical equipment down, those sorts of things. It's a benefit of virtualization. But what that means over time is that virtual machines may end up as a bit of a mix and match with, you know, not really knowing, you know, if you've got a nice balanced workload across the host, but from an exchange point of view, that might be suboptimal. You might have, you know, two DAG members sitting next to each other on the same physical machine. So the placement becomes pretty important, and you really need to watch out for that over time. And one of the things I'd suggest is if you have a big virtual infrastructure, have tiers of services within there, Exchange being a big advanced app, have it in the top tier where you've got, you know, strict resource allocation, you've got rules around movement, rules around sharing and those sorts of things, so you don't mix up and you don't end up in that scenario with too many eggs in one basket. You know, watch out for that. And that will happen over time. You've got to watch out for it and plan for it and design for it and make sure that your operational people understand Exchange and what Exchange needs to perform how you design it. People often forget about storage here. The Exchange, as I said, is really important on the database, so storage is really important for it. And the placement of that is very, very key. And without having HA against your storage or sufficient I/O becomes a bit of a problem, and you need to consider that, especially when you're moving things around. And the type of storage you have becomes pretty important. So again, watch out for that. Make sure when you move things around, all of those things are maintained, because sometimes they're not. I won't really dwell on these too much. They're, again, important considerations, what you're doing. There's pretty clear guidance around all of these things. For example, VHDs or virtual disks use fixed size, don't use variables, those sorts of things. You know, standard design practice that you need to consider when you're designing an Exchange platform. DAS is an interesting one. Has anyone actually deployed on JBOD? No one. I'm really surprised about that, actually. Typically, you'll get a few hands up. A lot of people haven't braved up on that one yet. But it's a valid choice. In a virtual land, it's a little bit more difficult, depending on the type of HA and things you've got. But DAS is where the world's going, unfortunately. SANs for big mailboxes are becoming uneconomic, and people are moving away from them. So, yeah, interesting, quite interesting. I'll just talk about the last point there. All the other ones, again, pretty obvious, and you've probably seen and read about those before if you've already virtualized your Exchange. But NAS is a good one. I've seen a lot of people deploy Exchange over NAS over the years, and I always get gobsmacked that they actually do that. The guidance is pretty clear that it needs to be block-level storage, and NAS is not, even though some NAS pretends to be. Just don't go and do that. Typically, when you shut your server down or dismount your store, about that moment in time it corrupts, and then you get to fix it or restore it. So, just don't go there on NAS. Has anyone ever done that and had a really great experience? Had a good experience? Oh, good experience. Oh, interesting. I wouldn't mind talking to you afterwards and understand a little bit more about your scenario, because it's always good to know those things. But, from a support point of view, no. Deploying is really easy, really interesting. Exchange is not sysprep friendly. It's an AD, it's on the machine, it's everywhere. So you can't sysprep it. You've got to find a better way to deploy it. So over the last 6 months, anyone who knows me knows I'm not a scripter. PowerShell to me is a challenge. In fact, typically if I go to a presentation like you guys are and code ends up on the screen, I go to sleep about 2 seconds later. So it's been a bit of a challenge, but I've written a script that automatically deploys based on a topology file, and it just goes and does the business. It's something I encourage you all to do, because consistency drives reliability in Exchange. And if you're going to be moving things around, creating things, dropping things off, having a repeatable scripted method to do that makes a lot of sense. So I certainly encourage you to do that. The idea of a starter image is a good one. I assume everyone uses automated server builds here. It's a reasonable assumption. Just have a version of your server build that has all the components on for Exchange. I typically just put them all on, no matter which role, because I'm going to be chopping and changing roles and services anyway. Certainly something to build it in, which makes an Exchange build. Even in my very low-powered lab at home, I can usually knock an Exchange server out in about 10 minutes. So, in the lab environment, which I use it for, is great because it's quick. In a production environment, that allows you to adapt, and use some of the advantages that virtualization brings by, dynamically provisioning services. HA is a very important design thing, and the interesting thing about this one for Exchange is Exchange has a lot of built-in capabilities, which Scott talked about yesterday, and we'll talk about some more tomorrow in an unbelievably deep way. So does virtualization. And this is an area where support has changed with Exchange 2010 SP1. So there are some changes in there around what is supported. So live migration is now supported. Snapshotting migration is not, for the reasons I talked about before. So just think about that and where you're going to do things. And you can't do it everywhere. You've got to choose where you're going to do it. One of the problems that this does create is because of the Exchange's unawareness of virtualization and vice versa, that often it requires some collaboration between the virtualization team and the exchange team. In a small shop, that's probably okay because they're probably the same people, but in a larger shop, they are definitely different people, so some coordination is required. Most of that stuff's pretty obvious, and if you're doing exchange, you'll probably understand that. But you know, again, part of the trade-off here, whether you're going to go virtualization or stay on physical, is what you're going to do about DAGs. Because DAGs do provide you that data level protection and high availability that most people seek in messaging platforms nowadays. The Exchange team did it for that very reason. It's a sensible, easy way to have high availability without the complexity that a lot of other things do bring along. And high availability in virtualization can be quite complicated. So one of your design decisions that you have to make is, where are you going to do your HA? You know, I personally have a preference for doing it in Exchange with DAGs, because as an Exchange guy, working with Exchange administrators, they can handle the whole shooting match themselves. And again, I said, if you're going to go down some of the other paths, you've got to involve other people. And usually when bad things start happening, everybody's priorities get all mixed up. You know, the VI guys will have certain priorities, the Exchange guys will have some other priorities, and getting them to achieve the appropriate outcome is a challenge. Whereas if the Exchange guys can own the whole lot, they can manage that outcome themselves. And I'm actually a bit of a fan for that, because it's just one of those keep it simple things. So yeah, watch out for that. Make the right decision when you can. Again, there's lots of other things that will drive you down certain paths. The host-based clustering is an interesting one. I'm not going to jump into that. That's been covered in other sessions about you know, how that all works and the ins and outs of that and the considerations for that. So you know, have a look at those other slide decks. Again, I'm not going to go into detail, but again, Exchange is not aware. Follow your vendors, your hypervisor vendors' guidance, and that should take you to a place where you know where you want to go. But just understand that the trend is for larger mailboxes. You know, no user says, "Hey, give me a smaller mailbox." Has anyone ever had that said to them? I never have. It's always, "Why isn't my mailbox the size of the moon?" You know, so that's what I hear. And that's what the product's designed to do. I think the target mailbox size for 2010 was 10 gig, which is about 5 years mail for an average corporate user. So, you know, DAGs manage that stuff really well. Virtualization can handle that, but, you know, in a non-native way. So, you know, just watch out for that, you know, how you're going to do that. Migration. Moving workloads around, I talked about how, you know, from a design point of view, you need to consider the placement of these things, not only from a workload perspective, but from an HA perspective. Just think about those things. Make sure you understand them and you're making conscious decisions about them. I really like the idea of off-peak. You know, if you're a large shop, that might be something you're doing. Is anyone doing off-peaking, you know, shutting things down at night, weekends? Moving workloads around dynamically, anyone doing that? Right. And I'm not surprised. That's the very large shops, because the incremental cost of setting those things up is pretty high, and you get the benefit over time. But I certainly, in the larger platforms that I've seen, that people do that. For example, in Exchange land, CAS servers is a great one. You know, if users aren't using it, which happens 2 days a week typically, why do you need a full complement of CAS servers sitting there in an array? You know, you don't. You can cut down the numbers of those that you have. So you could shrink that number down to a sufficient number for the weekend and then fire them back up for the Monday morning peak. So, you know, quite an interesting. Has anyone considered doing that? Anyone looking at it? No? No, okay, that's interesting. A few considerations there. I know these were covered off yesterday, but you know, the guts of it from a design point of view is in that operational process, such to minimise that blackout time, which is the time that the Exchange is not listening or talking. That needs to be really quick. And that, again, reflects back on the client view. Fortunately, Outlook 2010 is a lot smarter with handling those type of outages, because they're talking to the CAS server. The CAS server's managing some of that for you. But at a client level, it can just handle, slowdowns and lack of availability by just going offline. And in the early days of Outlook, it used to just freeze and often required a reboot or kill the process. But nowadays, it can handle it quite easily. So just watch out for minimising the outage time. And I've talked about the design thing. This is an operational design thing now too. You can't just have your detailed design and your build doc and all of that and throw it over the fence like a grenade. You know, you've got to help your operations people design their operational processes, because these are not simple processes sometimes. So working with them, you know, you're giving them a new tool set, albeit the Exchange System Manager or PowerShell, or you're giving them some scripts or whatever you're giving them, you can't just throw it over the fence. They need to understand the process and how to drive it and make sure that they sequence it properly to get the outcome you're looking for. So just, you know, these things can be complicated. Just make sure you help your operational people pick it up. Private cloud, is anyone thinking about that? Anyone? A few people? Yeah, it's an interesting concept. I typically call it a data center, but it's an interesting one. But what it actually drives, though, and this is the interesting concept for Exchange, is this concept of resource units. I don't know if other people call them that. That's what I call them. And a resource unit, in my view, is a virtual machine. And they tend to categorize them in sizes, you know, where they have big ones and medium ones and little ones. And typically none of them suit what you want for Exchange. And that's the drama we have about how do we fit into this world of commodity services or whatever you want to call it. It's a real challenge for Exchange because, coming back, we're an advanced workload. We're big on everything. Not typically well suited for a one-size-fit-all scenario. So just watch out for that. If you're going to go down that path, and I know some of you will, or you may outsource that to somebody else, you know, watch out for that with Exchange. You know, I talked about the core count before. You know, typically they don't go very large in private cloud scenarios. They are buying commodity two-socket machines. That's going to limit what you can do with virtualization with mailbox servers. It's going to drive you typically to have a lot more than you really want. So just watch out for that one and how they allocate the resources. I had an interesting case a while ago where the compute platform that was offered to us was gold-plated Rolls-Royce with platinum tyres, and it was a very expensive platform, but the average machine size was relatively puny. So the ratio of VMs versus physical we got was very poor. And that's not a bad thing, but it just made the solution quite expensive. Whereas if it was, you know, more cores, you know, more sockets and all of that, it would have been a lot cheaper in terms of the service we were trying to create. So just watch out for that when you're in that scenario. It doesn't always work for Exchange. Balancing, you've got to watch out. This is a classic one in virtualization, which always kills me, and you tend to have battles on this one, yeah, about over, under allocation, all of that, over subscription, all of that other virtualization speak about taking resources away from Exchange. You know, Exchange doesn't like that. It'll take everything you give it all the time, and it is unhappy usually about giving it back because it's tuned for performance, it's tuned for I/O, it's tuned for managing connections with clients. That's what it does. It's a big app. So taking things away from it is only going to slow it down. So if you imagine the scenario where you have memory allocated to a mailbox server and you've decided it's got too much and you take some of it away, what is it going to do? It's going to page all that memory out, flush the disks, and start going really slow while it retunes itself, if it can, if you've taken that much memory away from it. Which again, from a client point of view, is not flash. It means they slow down. So just be aware, you know, the guidance is, if you're going to give it memory, give it all the memory you can. If you're going to give it CPUs, just allocate them permanently and not let it tune itself. Storage is the same. There's some cleverness in storage nowadays about, you know, mapping things around. You know, Exchange will use it again, everything you give it. So don't try and scrimp on that one, because it will catch you out and users will start getting some pretty ordinary performance. Again, these went through yesterday, and I encourage you to look at these things. I look at them all the time, especially the SVVP, the Virtualization Validation Program. It has a pretty funky wizard in there that you could go through, you know, select the application you're going for, select your virtualization platform, and it will give you a statement around its supportability and if there's any caveats. Okay, and the caveats are things that will change over time as virtualization matures and things change and the platform comes up to meet it, if you like. So I'd encourage you to go and look at that all the time, or every time you go to design something or do something or anything around virtualization, regardless of it being Exchange or not. This here is a great resource, which I actually use all the time as well. And I use it as a validation, because quite often when you're working in isolation, doing a design, you end up with something, you go, yeah, that looks really great. And then you look at one of these and you go, wow, why is that so different? So it's a great comparison thing. You've got to be careful that, the design inputs they use are similar to yours, because, that makes a huge difference. But there's some pretty handy things in there as well. There's some links there, and there's also some links from Microsoft.com downloads as well. And that's just a handy resource. And if you're lucky enough that your organisation looks like any of those there, pick it up and run with it, because that's a fully validated design. They've load genned it, they've jet stressed it, they've run it in production. They've done all of those things to it, and they validate every decision they've made. So they're really, really handy resources. And in fact, if you look at any one of those, if you model your design process on that, you'll probably end up with a good solution. So I certainly encourage you to go and look at there as a solution designer. The guidance, the support guidelines. This is a real killer, this one. The Exchange Group, for a long time, it's fair to say, weren't positive about virtualization. They were pretty neutral and sometimes say things that, you'd look at it and go, crikey. But, since 2007, they've certainly supported virtualization. 2010 in a bigger way, and SP1 more again. So it's changing. That's the theme here. So that is the single point of truth, and I encourage you to go there every time you do an Exchange design, anytime you're thinking about changing things, and certainly anytime you're looking to virtualize Exchange. There's a whole section on virtualized hardware. It's quite detailed. If you're confused about it and you have Premier support, you should be going back through your TAM or whoever and getting clarification on that, because again, that support demarcation point is important. The sizing calculator, I talked about that before. I love this tool. And the guys that build this tool are hilarious, and they spend a lot of time thinking about this stuff. The new thing here is that it supports a selection around server role virtualization, but the important note here, that's actually for Hyper-V. So if you're using another vendor's hypervisor, you need to have a look at that. There is a place in there where you can customize the amount of overhead that goes against, in its calculation. So again, look at that, make sure you get that right. I think in there now it's around 10%. But, as time goes on, I think, the virtual platforms will get smarter. The hardware's certainly getting better. The hypervisors are getting better. That number will decrease over time. So just make sure you account for that. A couple of other interesting things that I encourage you to have a look at, especially the systems requirement that also highlights what you need to know about virtualization. And a new paper out there about planning desired Exchange 2010 with Service Pack 1. Again, there's some virtualization pieces in there that should help you with your decision making. So I won't cover the summary. I know I've torn through that pretty quickly. I want to talk through an example that I've had recently. I've talked about it before, the 50,000 seat one, and some of the challenges that I've had there. Some of them I've covered. I want to drill into them a bit more. If you've got any questions about this particular one, could you just put your hand up? Any generic questions about what we've been talking about, we'll cover those at the end. So the challenge I had with this one was it's a new platform. It's a new AD Forest. And we're bringing in three organisations with, I think there's two more to come. So it's almost a shared services scenario where we will have people from different organisations sharing this infrastructure while they still live on their old infrastructure, but they will be moving to this infrastructure. I know that sounds a bit complicated, but that's the way this works. So some of the challenges we had were around the virtual infrastructure, that they have a virtualisation first strategy. So that says to me that if I don't want to do that, I have to make a case, which is fair enough. So when we first got into it, it was pretty black and white that we were going to be forced down that path. So we got engaged with the virtualization people and talked to them about how Exchange works. And often the virtualization guys, they tend to come from a hardware background. They don't always know how Exchange works. It's a bonus if you've got someone who knows how it works, but you need to spend the time and explain how it works to them. And I spent quite a bit of time doing that, and that was very helpful in our processes. The challenge we had was their hardware was not new. It was AMD based, which in virtual land, as it turns out, isn't that common. And we were limited to a 6-core socket. And as the example I used before, we really wanted 16. And I had a look at that, and what I decided was for our mailbox servers, I was happy to take that hit and remove the headroom we had on CPU. And the main reason why I did that is because one thing this customer does have is a large VI platform. So if I get stuck with that, I can take advantage of the exchange features, which is the scale out. I can just put more mailbox servers in to solve that problem. I didn't want to go in and do the 2.5 times piece to begin with, because that would have been putting 40 or 50 servers in straight out of the gate, and that was unsustainable. So we decided to stay with that and take advantage of that. But one of the things I didn't compromise on, we went for a combination hub transport CAS server. So we're going to be having 50-odd thousand users coming in for that. We're doing about 1.1 million messages a day through the hub at the moment. So they're pretty busy machines. So I didn't compromise on that. So we actually, the number I originally designed for was around 10. So we've gone to 15 just to manage that risk. But again, as the users come on, because they'll be migrating over time, we're going to monitor that. And again, if we have to, we'll just scale out. So that, again, is taking advantage of some of the benefits of a virtualized. There's no procurement cycle that you have to go through to bring in hardware and get them racked and stacked and cabled and all that other physical stuff you have to do. It's like, can we have some more of these, please? And they go, okay, do the process, bang, they're there a couple of days later. So again, it's sort of playing both sides of the fence, I know, but ultimately it's heading for a solution that's sustainable going forward. So has anyone else come across the problem of the core limitations? No one? Wow, I'm feeling special. Very interesting. So how many people have popped Exchange 2010 on virtualization in here so far? A couple of people? Yeah. Interesting. So the challenges, do you have challenges along the way?
It depends on my client.
Okay.
If it's a small deployment, I will. Mm. If it's a large deployment, definitely physical.
Yeah. And did you catch the right answer? It depends. Yeah. So this was a pretty challenging one, just because it was a whole new thing. We were given a very short amount of time to do it, so you tend to make stuff up as you go. But we did have a good fundamental design that we started with, and that helped us, with our decision-making processes. But as we bring users on, which we've started doing now, we are monitoring it closely. We've got SCOM on it with all the management packs on, and we are watching it very closely to see how it performs under load. So we can make an earlier decision whether we need to scale out or not, or in fact we may not have to do anything, so time will tell. All right, question over here?
Yeah, question. With the CAS hub transport servers that you actually had, because you had 15 servers,
yeah.
Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Were you using any hardware load balancers then?
Yes, we were. Great question. So the question was, with the 15 or so combination hub transport CAS servers we were using, were we use hardware load balancing? And we were. Another limitation we had at the time, the only load balancers we had available to us were SourceNet load balancers. So from an SMTP point of view, that was okay. From a client point of view, it wasn't so okay. So what we're currently doing, because we're still in a pilot phase, is we're not load balancing client traffic. We're just redirecting it with a CNAME at the moment onto a single host. 100 users isn't going to bother it too much. But all of our SMTP traffic is load balanced, yes. Question back there?
For the 50,000 quota,
great question. So the question is, what sort of quota did we have on? And that was actually a real challenge for us to come up with in the first instance, because we had three organisations with three sets of rules. Some of them had relatively small quotas because of hardware limitations. Some of them had no quotas because you can't tell people they have a quota, apparently, and things like that. So I did the classic, I think it should be a gigabyte, and I just socialised that. And so it turns out that most people thought that was okay, and it's still a gigabyte, but I expect that once we get into the migration and we get into the organisation that has no limits, I'm sure that's going to change. But I've accounted for that in the storage design anyway. I built in two layers of users, and some of them with 5 gig mailboxes. Any other questions? Nick?
So with the mailbox architecture, were you looking at storing the Exchange databases on a virtualized disk system there, or are you looking at using pass-through directly to
send? Yep. Great question. So were we looking at going on to a virtualized disk or a pass-through? In this particular case, it's pass-through, and it's fibre channel pass-through. This particular customer has an extensive SAN arrangement, and we are going on to expensive disk, basically, which is a shame because we don't need to, but that's what they have, so that's what we use. So in this particular case, it's pass-through, and the performance we're getting is pretty slick. But it's more than we need. Yeah, it's one of those classic cases of this is what we have, and we have one tier of service, and it's Rolls-Royce, and so it's like fine. Over here again.
One more question. So in terms of the actual mailbox service, can you talk about the backdoor recovery strategy that you guys have there? Is it lag copies, multiple data centers?
Yep, great question. And this is another area where I've had to temporarily compromise. The customer has a single high availability data center strategy where they actually have two virtual data centers in adjacent buildings that are physically separated, but they are in the same geographic location. And I look at that and go, yeah, I can see the merits in that in certain situations. I can see how we can use that from an Exchange point of view where we'll put half and half. At the end of the day, if a plane crashes into it, it's still all gone. So what I've been working towards, they do have a DR strategy, which is for passive workloads. In other words, clients don't connect to it. So currently what I'm doing is putting half and half in the two virtual data centres, and when the other one gets built, because it's in construction at the moment, we will put our passive backup or DR systems in there with a passive, clients don't connect it. So that gives us high availability in the primary and then a DR in the backup data center. But it's often a curly question, because we ask for so much storage, 50,000 users, three copies, a gigabyte each, that's not a small number. And we want it yesterday afternoon, of course. So yeah, it's a tough one, but we're going to stage out in this particular case. Oh no, it is DAG based. It'll ultimately be a three copy DAG. We're going to put two DAGs in, eight servers in each. So that gives us some growth space in the DAGs if we do have to scale out, which I think we will over time because mail's not getting less used; it's getting more used. So I expect that we'll be doing that over time. Yeah. From a backup point of view, we are still backing it up. Unfortunately, the customer's backup solution doesn't support Exchange 2010, so we've put in a temporary Data Protection Manager 2010 solution specifically to look after our system, and then we're backing that up with their tape libraries and all the other stuff that they have. So it's not an ideal situation, but because we're having to manage the DPM in the interim, but it was the only go forward, so we did that. Over here. Quest. Question, Daniel?
How do your customers react when you propose the idea of native data protection?
So the question is, how do my customers react with native data protection? So what you're saying is no physical backup,
Yep. Just
multiple copies. Okay, so in this case, we're not doing that. I have proposed that once, but what shot that one down was, paranoia in the first case. But the second one was they just didn't have the disk capacity and the geographic dispersion to really make that a viable solution. But, yeah, it's a tough conversation, that one. But I think it's a valid conversation. You think about it in the context of the really big systems. So I'm talking about Live at EDU. I don't know if you're familiar with Live at EDU. So that's the platform that Microsoft's Exchange team have built, and it is, given to universities for students and sometimes staff. So it's a free system. It is basically Office 365, the Outlook piece of it. So you get our Outlook Anywhere, mobile phones, all that sort of stuff. And that's about 30 million users now. So that's a big system. Are they really honestly going to back that up? I don't think so. So they work in a multi-copy situation for that. And all the big guys do that. They're all cheap and cheerful hardware, four copies, and that's how they do the backup. So, yeah. Another one over here.
Spoken quite a bit about the CAS hub and the mailbox servers. In terms of the front-end infrastructure, so edge servers and the actual relays, anti-spam, antivirus, how are you handling that in that department?
Okay, so we're not doing that. That's outside of our scope. The question was, how are we handling the perimeter, which is the edge services? This customer has all their own infrastructure out on the edge, and it's quite significant. So we are sitting behind that. In saying that, though, we are using edge servers. We have five of those, and that's specifically to do domain rewrite. So they're going to, once we finish the migration, they'll just get decommissioned and moved off. But yeah, but in our case, we're purely Exchange and some Quest components to manage the interop and stuff with Domino and Exchange 2003. There's a few other questions. Oh, yeah, sorry, down here.
Very little mentioned about AD infrastructure. Did you virtualize that?
Excellent question. So did we virtualize the Active Directory infrastructure? And we did and we didn't. So in this particular case, we followed Microsoft's guidance on this one. So we do have, and it's outside of my sphere, but I know we do have two physical domain controllers in the root domain and two physical domain controllers in the child domain, and all the rest are virtual. In our world, I've actually, because again, we're moving into an environment where we didn't have a lot of metrics about how things were going to behave. So we actually, in this case, which not many people do nowadays, but we actually have a dedicated Exchange Active Directory site with dedicated domain controllers and global catalog servers. So that's just a risk mitigation strategy. They're all virtual. And what we'll do over time is monitor those, see what the impact is, do we really need them, and then make a decision in 12 to 24 months whether they stay or not. Yep, sorry for interrupting you. Yeah, no, good point. So is anyone using native Exchange data protection down the back there? Yeah? Anyone else? Yeah? I know you are. And down the back there? That's really great. Again, I wouldn't mind talking to you afterwards because from my point of view, you know, the more I understand about how customers make that decision, it will help me sort of describe it a bit better because usually the first conversation is like, get out of here, stop talking to me about that stuff. We've done this for 20 years. Why would we change? But when you've got, you know, hundreds and hundreds of gigabytes or terabytes of mail, you know, the whole backup thing just becomes a bit of a laugh, really. But, yeah. Alrighty, any other questions before I wrap up? And I understand that we've got two prizes. So I'm going to ask Scott to make up a question. He didn't know that was coming, by the way. Yeah.
And if they don't answer, I get the prize, right?
No, I get the prize.
No? Oh, yeah. Well then, what's Sandy's middle name?
No, I've got a better question. What is my first name?
Oh.
Well, no, it's not, actually. Yeah, you know. Yeah, they know. Yeah, no, let me wrap up, and if you could think up a couple of... Or Mario. Yeah. As I said, we've had to rush through a bit because we realised that the content police didn't catch some of the duplicates we had, so... Anyway, so just to wrap up, so, you know, does anyone feel as though they're in a better position to make that decision about virtualizing Exchange? You understand more about, well, what I think about, and, you know, these are conversations that I have a lot with people. It is a tough decision, don't get me wrong, and it does depend, and I know I'm flippant about that, but it really does depend, and it really understand all your inputs, understand what you're trying to achieve. You know, if your achievement is to get virtualized, well, that's a relatively easy thing to do, but is that really what you want from a messaging point of view? Sorry.
Just a quick question. Obviously, you deal with a lot of different clients. How many of them decide not to go with virtualization or, you know, decide not to deploy a virtualized solution? How many of it is a client decision versus your, you know, this isn't going to work for you?
Yep, good question. So the question is from a, you know, how many customers choose to go virtualization or, you know, go through a process? They go through a process before they make a decision. In my experience, not many actually go through a process. It's like, we're doing virtualization, let's go there, which is fine. And if that's a business requirement, you include it in your thinking, you know. But at the end of the day, you know, you can get to a point where you're saying, you're going to put in 50 servers, you need 15. Why would you do that? And I tend to position things back that way and say, well, why would you do that? And you know, again, it usually depends on who's got the most power to who wins that discussion, whether the virtualization guys do or the exchange guys do or people above them. But it's a tough one because it is a big trend, and it's a good trend, that people are thinking about these things. But there is no simple answer. And I tend to take a position, if people are just insistent on going virtualized, which is fine, I don't have a great problem with that. But if I believe it's a risky approach or they're not considering all the things, I'll usually just tell what they are. That's all I can do. But also, too, I always have a plan B if that doesn't work for you. And it's typically on the mailbox servers, right, that have a compromise, have the capability of bringing in physical. And that's a trend that I'm seeing, is that the rush for virtualization is, I think, kind of sort of peaking, and people are realizing, it's not a one-size-fits-all scenario here, that there are certain situations where having virtualized services doesn't make sense. And mailbox servers often fall into that bucket. So I always say, well, if you want to go down that road, that's fine. Let's manage that process. Let's monitor it. Let's see how it goes. Let's make sure we get all the ducks lined up. But if that doesn't work, be prepared to come over here and do it over here as well. Because, from an exchange point of view, exchange doesn't care. But from a topology point of view, it does make quite a difference. So, yeah. But no, that's a great question. So just to summarise again, think about these things, think through them logically. Don't take the default answer of we must virtualise. Push through it. Understand it. And if you have to, just account for it. Account for it in your operations. Make sure that your virtualization people understand the restrictions you have around supportability, the core ratios, the memory, the storage. Make sure they put it into a tier of services that gives you what you need, that it's not dynamic, it's not taking things away, that it is what it is. Just make sure you get that. And I think if you follow that through logically, you build some good operational documentation and processes around what you've done, you will be successful at it, I have no doubt. But if you miss some of those things out, you could get hosed down quite quickly. And the biggest one I see is the movement of machines around, where you might end up with roles, on the same host, in the same blade enclosure, whatever, that a problem with those will give you a big problem with Exchange. So that's my main guidance here, is watch out for that. Listen to your hypervisor vendor. They do a lot of testing themselves. They do a lot of testing with Microsoft about the supportability of things. Listen to what they say. Sometimes you have to look at that with a pinch of salt, because sometimes, reading it off a 1A4 Markitecture page is probably not the best place to get their advice, but they do have a lot of advice if you drill into their websites about what they're really talking about. So, definitely pay attention to that stuff. And then, I think you'll make the right decision. Just think about all the things you need to think about. So that's all I really wanted to cover today. I'm sorry I've been a bit quick through this, and I know I do talk quick, but is there any other questions just to finish up on? So, Scott, got some questions?
Well, since it was brought up, can anybody tell us what Exchange Native Data Protection actually is?
So the question is, can anyone please describe what Exchange Native Data Protection is? Over here.
That's wrong. So that would be wrong. Using the DAG is only part of it. Anybody else want to take another? No.
No, there's one back there.
Three more copies in a DAG. That's what he said. No, the DAG itself and those copies are only part of it. The DAG alone doesn't allow you to eliminate backups.
Using lag copies?
Using lag copies, no. I think, go back here. In the dark shirt, then we'll move our way up. Single item retention, yes. Yes, what else?
The DAG already mentioned.
Yep, you got it.
Okay, come on up. You got another question, Scott? Mario?
Go ahead, ask the VM migration.
The other question is, what are the VM migration technologies from Hyper-V?
We won't go in any hypervisors. But for Hyper-V, what are the VM migration technologies that we support for DAGs in Service Pack 1? Let's go over here. Got it, yep.
Okay, fantastic.
Which one's not supported? Snapshot or save state, that's right.
Yep.
Exactly.
All right, come on up. Well, thanks, everyone. Appreciate that. If you've got any other questions, just come on up or come and talk to me as I walk around.